research, and it was through that work that I started working on this project, which when it loads, is a focus on sustainability of rural primary care programs. And yes, I have no things to disclose. So I'm looking at long-term sustainability in rural health centers, and I do a case study of four health centers that actually come from a follow-up study that was done at UNC back in the late 70s into the 80s. And that was a time not too long after community health centers in general had sort of started to spring up. And so there were different sort of programs that looked like health centers or that were trying to serve that same population. And there wasn't at that time an evaluation of the different typologies and their relative effectiveness. So that was the reason why they started the study that they did. So then I pick up 30 years after their study concludes to try to figure out what are the factors that may be responsible for keeping certain organizations going while others close, because these rural primary care facilities face even more challenging financial and non-financial threats than other safety net providers would. So the original studies that they did found that the majority of the programs had difficulty covering their expenses, that financial instability was consequently a major concern, that relationships between clinics and hospitals in the area made clinics more likely to be financially self-sufficient, and a lot of other studies subsequently have borne that sort of thing out. And then one in four programs actually reported difficulty recruiting and retaining clinical staff. So you see an issue just operating as well as maintaining adequate margins. So as far as what I did, like I said, it's case study design. I took the programs that were in the original file and then used HRSA records to identify the programs that were still in operation. And then the four cases I selected were actually drawn based on information-oriented sampling. So another way to say that is there just seemed to be the most things in the file to say about those places. They had the best stories to tell. So I reviewed a whole bunch of files, and we had tons and tons of banker's boxes full of original materials, be it newspaper clippings, brochures, interview notes, photographs, and this sort of thing. And I constructed narratives about these programs and tried to order things chronologically. And then also looked for keywords both out of the organizational literature on sustainability as well as anything that might come up in the documents that I was sifting through, so sort of in an open-ended process. And I searched online to find out as much as I could that was available online about these programs that were still operating, and added that current information into these narratives, and then looked across those stories to kind of see, okay, what themes are really emerging. So the codes, or the themes that I used to code, were program origins, community demographics, community attitudes towards the program. So was there a lot of hostility and resentment early on when the program was established or not? Was it something that was done in a grassroots way that everybody supported? Program interaction within the community, clinician recruitment and retention, which, as noted before, they found a big problem with that. Clinicians' attitudes towards the community, so are these clinicians there because they want to be, and are they really actively involved, or are they there like out of a National Health Service Corps obligation, something like that, and once their time's up, they're kind of going to get on out of town. Revenues and funding, obviously, that's, finances is a big part of your sustainability of your organization, and then any actions that show up in the record that they did to avoid closing, where that was ever noted. So this shows you the 998 organizations that were originally surveyed back in the previous study, and the steps that they went through, all the way to 467 of them that were included for a more in-depth study, and then they did a stratified random sample out of those 467 to select 40 sites where they actually made site visits, which is actually a lot of site visits. And they were drawn all around the country, so it was a pretty big undertaking. Out of those 40, 10 by now have closed. So then that left me 30 to choose from, and then I, like I said, picked my four from that 30 based on the information that was available to me. So now I'll just give you a real quick snapshot. I won't have much time to paint a good picture of these cases, but the first place I chose was the Laurel Fork Clear Fork Health Centers located in Clearfield, Tennessee. That was the first health center in Tennessee. It's a very low-income Appalachian area. It's a coal mining town, I think still to this day, in fact. And the real instrumental individual there is this Dr. Jesse Walker, who came in. He was actually not from the area, but he was rural born, and so had an affinity to working in rural areas. And he actually was able to keep several clinic sites open by using nurse practitioners and physician assistants, which at the time was still not a very widespread practice. So he got a lot of flack for doing that, actually. And as you see also, the Reagan administration, there were a lot of cutbacks to health centers. So they closed the Laurel Fork Center but kept the Clear Fork system open. So they were forced to kind of make a choice. I would suggest if they would have not done that, if they had tried to keep them both open, it's possible that both would have ended up closing. And back then, they had 6,500 patient visits a year. So now, in 1998, they were reorganized. They're now a federally qualified health center, known as the Dayspring Family Health Center. They still have the Clear Fork site operational. They now see 44,000 patients a year. And they're affiliated with the Jellicoe Community Hospital in the area, and they just in 2002 were awarded an almost $2 million federal grant. So they have come quite a long way. The TESH Action Clinic is in Franklin, Louisiana. That also was the first health center in Louisiana. It had a little bit rocky of a start. It was opposed by what I say here is the white aristocracy, and I think really that's not a term I would throw around other than to say when I read in the files, they actually referred to sugar plantations down there, and that the board of the hospital was composed of these plantation owners, and so they used this to actually pressure folks into using their hospital and not working outside of the plantations and all this sort of thing. And this is in the late 60s and early 70s. So there was a lot of opposition, most of it racial. And the clinic started from a human relations council that was created to address that racial tension. And an interesting thing that happens is that the community opposition seemed to be overcome because there was a local physician who decided to get involved with the clinic. And that did a couple of things. One, he was white, and I think it kind of bridged the racial divide. But also, because it was a physician, it brought on board a lot of the other clinical faculty at the hospital. So he really brought everyone together. Also, I just made a note, they used the nurse practitioners and physician's assistants as well. So that was them back then. Now, the top dog there is Dr. Gary Wiltz. He's been at TESH for more than 25 years. He started there actually as part of his National Health Service Corps obligation and has just stayed around. Actually, I've got the slide on him a little bit later on. I'll talk about him more then. But so they serve over 8,000 patients now. They have four sites that they expanded. And they report being 60% self-sufficient and 40% reliant on federal grants. Those aren't fantastic numbers, but that's really not uncommon for these types of establishments just because of their patient mix. They're never going to move to being completely self-sufficient. There is a little bit of uncertainty going forward in the post-Katrina world. The population in Franklin has dropped considerably. It was actually dropping before the hurricane, and it continued to drop really steadily after. So it begins to become kind of a question of whether it can continue to sustain the operation. La Clínica del Pueblo de Rio Arriba is out in Tierra Amarilla, New Mexico. It was established in 1969 to serve the indigenous population there, and there was a lot of unrest in that part of the state that had to do with dispute over land between indigenous populations and then white landowners, and so racial in a different way. from the Louisiana case. There were actually two competing clinics. So there was the La Clinica, and then there was a clinic opened up to the north that was opened by the folks in power, the listed there, the elected officials, bankers, and landowners. And actually, those people are charged with, and I don't know that this has ever been confirmed, but burning down La Clinica at one point. So it got really pretty heated. And part of the result of this is that La Clinica doesn't seem to trust anyone outside of themselves to support their effort. So now, they didn't grow for a long time, but they somehow managed to just sort of hold on. Then in 1992, they started to go outside of themselves for support and receive federal grant funds for the first time. And then after that, it's triggered sort of a cascade of establishing external relations with other health centers and collaboratives. So they seem to be expanding now that they've opened up and not remained quite so closed off as they were before. And the last case was the Yuba Feather Communities Health Program in Brownsville, California, which was established in 1974 up in Northern California. And it was actually an example of a community that didn't face a bunch of opposition. It was just started by a local resident who saw a need. And then Drs. Hoffman and Rose have been there pretty much since the inception of the program. I think both of them actually still work there today. So, you know, whatever that works out to, 34, 35 years now. They're very involved in the community, according to the reports that I read. Again, as is similar to what I've mentioned out in the Tennessee example, where they had to close one of the sites, they did the same thing here, where they had two sites, and then one just wasn't cutting it, so they had to close the doors rather than pull the whole operation down. So now, like I say, Brownsville also faced financial hardship as their uninsured patient mix has grown, which is not anything unique to health centers. So they got affiliated with Southern North Medical Foundation in 1993, and that led them to federal funding eventually in 2002. So now they are getting increased Medicaid and Medicare payments. They have a much bigger facility. As I say over on the left-hand side, they started in two log cabins. They now have a 7,000 square foot facility, and they serve 10,000 patients. So what are some of the things I pulled out? One is physician advocates. It seems that these places have had a lasting figure that's hung around and really helped to define their mission. So Dr. Wiltz at Tesh and Dr. Hoffman at the Brownsville Clinic are two excellent examples of that. And those are direct quotes from both of them that just explain kind of how they happen to love what they do and have stayed where they are. And I don't know, I think it's interesting to wonder what makes a person feel that way, or, you know, is it something that we can instill or incentivize, or is it just in the person's personality? Another theme that comes out is that because of the unrest in New Mexico that led to La Clinica wanting to be so insular, they weren't very flexible and they sort of stagnated. So you can see in this quote that it says, you know, they haven't taken off and they won't because their philosophy keeps them from accepting any sort of outside help. And like I noted, once that changed, it seems like now things are starting to grow out there. So I'm just repeating my findings here. Physician advocates with long tenure dedicated to the community, the adoption of innovative practices. So that at the time was, say, using nurse practitioners and physician's assistants to be able to reach more people more effectively, more efficiently, for less money. And I say, you know, today this might be care management type things or like a promotoras model, something like that. Organizational flexibility. So whenever two satellites were operational and one was financially not well off, then they closed that one and were able to keep at least one of the two open. And then community integration. So being involved with a local hospital, so you have communities of scale that cut down a lot on your costs for things like lab work or imaging. So some limitations of what I've done, and there are probably many more than what are noted here. One is that I didn't focus at all on the 10 places that stopped operating to try to do a compare and contrast. And that was just because I would have only had the information that was in the files from the 70s and 80s, and that would have been it. So I couldn't have found anything much more recent. And that would have made it not very fun to compare. Problem also is that this leads to limited generalizability because, I did only pick out 4 places, and there is a little bit of subjectivity, or let's be honest, a lot of subjectivity in that process. But I do think that there is theoretical generalizability. So to the extent that, another rural primary care program resembles one of these places, I think you would see similar themes emerge. But those themes may or may not be causally related to the organization's long-term sustainability. And where do we go from here? Like I started out by saying, rural primary care programs are vulnerable organizations that serve vulnerable populations. There's a strong need to identify who that next generation of physician advocates is going to be, or if we can move beyond that, because it's not really the best position to be in to count on just one person to kind of serve as the backbone of your establishment. So are we going to focus on trying to find replacements for these people and groom that next generation, or can we figure out a way to move the clinics away from that dependency on any particular individual to help them more stable, become more stable despite turnover? It's also important to identify ways to make rural primary care programs robust to high rates of that turnover, and future studies need to focus on understanding the motivations that clinicians have to choose to practice in rural settings and to stay there. So that's not just a recruitment problem, but also a retention problem. And in my experience, recruitment is something that policy levers can be effective at addressing, but retention is much less so. So that is the end of my presentation. And now I can go back to moderating. You can escape on that.